broadcast out of New York City. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on Monday, March 11th, 2013. I'm Dr. Len Saputo. Nurse Vicky is in Alaska tracking a moose. Yeah, you heard me right. So no 2020 tips today until she returns. She's with her son up there in Alaska, who's a wildlife biologist, and he tracks moose or wolves or salmon or, bears, all kinds of things up there. And what they do is they give them a sedative. They shoot a dart at them. They go to sleep. They then draw some blood. They measure different kinds of measurements and then learn about how well the particular animal that they're tracking is doing. And Vicky loves moose. So she's up there doing that with him and won't be back for another week or 10 days. So anyway, I want to thank you for joining us on our Prescriptions for Health show on the Progressive Radio Network every Monday, live from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember that our shows are available 24/7 on prn.fm and drsaputo.com. And I have a great show for you today that's going to include what's the best way to deal with spousal abuse. Should we allow celebrity endorsements for food and drugs? Do school-based kitchen gardens work? Does exercise really improve sleep? And do conflict of interest policies in medical training work to reduce brand-name drugs in clinical practice? So we've got a really good show for you today. You know, this business of understanding spousal abuse is one that's complicated. And what we do is we generally tend to treat the problem after it's way out of hand. After there's a lot of abuse. In fact, we even go to the extent of having centers where women can go for protection, or even men sometimes are abused in a physical sort of way. And most of the stuff that we're looking at is physical abuse. How many times have we watched on TV or listened to a radio program where some poor woman is being abused or stalked or beaten up or shot or killed? Because there are problems within the marriage with both people having lots of problems. So again, you have to figure, why would people like this get together in the first place? And of course, there are all kinds of physical, sexual, emotional abusage that's possible. But we tend to focus mostly on women than men. And it's probably because men are stronger. They can assert themselves more. And of course, what you see then is the mayhem that men are doing to women. But when you think about it, are there any marriages that don't have some kind of abuse in them? What happens a lot of the time is after the marriage is, the honeymoon is over, after the first year or so, a lot of the time there are frustrations. It can be financial or have to do with family, a business of some kind, or other personal issues that lead people to become frustrated. And what happens? Then they wind up arguing, and it can lead to problems that can get out of hand. But do we really look at the underlying cause of why does this happen? We treat the symptoms after things get too far out of hand. It's like what we do in medicine anyway. We're busy looking at how are we going to block the symptoms from having rather than looking at what caused them and what can we do to make that situation different. And I'm not trying to let anybody off the hook. Nobody should abuse anybody. It should be against the law. There should be a punishment for it. And it needs to stop because it's not right. Well, what really leads to this a lot of the time? If you were really authentic when you were dating and you were going through the process of wooing one another, the relationships probably would be a lot clearer. What you see is what you'd get. The contract would be straightforward and you'd know what you were getting in for. But that doesn't happen a lot of the time. Look at how many people at any age don't have their issues worked out. We live in an emotional sea of dysfunction. How many families do you know that are actually functional? In a perfect sort of way? Probably none. So to expect that there would be problems in the relationships after we're living together, particularly if we have kids or we have problems that have developed that we can't deal with, it shouldn't be any surprise that we see lots of problems, things where people are not getting along and they're dancing on each other's buttons. Look at the fact that 50% of first marriages end in divorce. 67% of a second marriage will end in divorce. And 75% of a third marriage will end in divorce. So, and generally, 60% of those divorces occur within the first 10 years. So what do you do in this situation? How do you stop the dysfunctional nature of what's happening? How do we support people who turn to violent solutions because they can't stand it anymore? A lot of it just depends on how you're raised. Where you're raised in a large extent will depend on what happens to you and the way you run your life in a major way. You look at the places in this country where there's a lot of violence, physical, all these kinds of different violence. For example, the Iron Triangle in Richmond, California is well noted for having shootings and lots of prostitution and lots of drugs and lots of murders. I mean, it's a terrible thing. If you grew up in that setting, your chances of getting out of that setting are really pretty small. And a lot of those people live where? They live in the prisons of America, places like San Quentin, because that's what they've learned. They don't have role models that teaches them what they need to know to be able to function in a way where they can get along in some way that makes sense. So what happens is we wind up with all these things that happen to us. Where do the kids learn about healthy relationships? They wouldn't. How would they get it? They'll get some of it maybe in school, but when they come home and mom's not there for whatever reason, either because she's working doing what she's doing or dad's out selling drugs or what's happening there and there's a lot of violence around, you sort of learn what you have to do to survive. And a lot of these kids are winding up in gangs, both men and women. They're running away from home. They're on the streets. They have no way to make an income except in ways that are illegal or certainly not in their best interest. So how do we change that? We need to do something about trying to get rid of the disparities in this country. We have them in so many different places. The disparities that we see in business, in social recognition, the disparities we see in health care are enormous. If you are born with a silver spoon in your mouth, you've got a much better chance of getting an education and getting out of that situation. But don't think that just because you have a lot of money means that you're going to have a life that's really functional, that's going to serve you well, so you don't have to worry about having problems when you have a relationship. I mean, people who are wealthy have problems too. And they may not be problems that have to do with material things, and they have plenty of money, but where do they learn their values? And a lot of the time it's from parents who are doing things that you really wouldn't be very proud of. I mean, what do they do to make their money? It's very competitive and adversarial. The whole community operates that way. How do we get around that? Do we do it in our schools? Not so much. I like the idea of all schools having classes that have to do with how we learn to get along with each other. How do we learn the golden rule and have it mean something? How do we develop into a way that we can understand what a relationship means and how it can be comforting and supporting and loving when we're not in a place where we understand that ourselves and where our role models are not the ones we want to follow? If we had classes like that, it's very often we find in some schools, they're starting to come into them, where they're learning more than just about reading, writing, and arithmetic. They're actually learning about how we get along in life with each other. And so they meet in a formal class where they talk about their particular social challenges. And I think we need a lot more of that. The education that we have in this country is more geared to star testing. We're more interested in making rocket scientists and doctors and lawyers and other professionals than we are in making people who have values that they understand that are good values that are going to take them someplace in life. We have to do something to teach that. What we've got is a system where we're not exercising, we're not learning about how to respect other people as much. Our social skills are not what they should be. And it's worse, of course, if we live in areas where there's a lot of problems, a lot of social problems. So the Iron Triangle in Richmond, the city of Atlanta, the streets of New York where there are huge disparities, or in Brooklyn or in Chicago, the violence in this country may exceed what we see in terms of deaths than we see in Afghanistan these days. I mean, war definitely is dangerous, but there may be more in the way of deaths every year in this country. It's more dangerous to be a citizen who's not in Afghanistan. Not that I think it's a good idea to be in Afghanistan fighting, okay, a war that a lot of us have a problem with. So it's not just that we want to make people stop doing things by force. We have to inspire them. They have to want to change. They have to understand that if they do make changes from what they learned in a dysfunctional family, that it's possible to still recover from what happened and have a life that's developing relationships that are healthy. We should be learning to provide service or be engaged in service rather than just finding out what we can do for ourselves. Do we really need to have all this kind of mayhem going on because of what we're learning as kids? Is there no hope for us to get around it? I think that there is. And it's not just that men and women are different, that they don't get along. You know, we look at the book, Women Are from Venus and Men Are from Mars. Well, there's something to that. We do have hormonal differences that are important. Women generally are more affectionate and loving. They're more into the touchy-feely things, the relationship means the most. And men are out trying to make a living, competing, whether it be in sport or business or whatever it is in our culture where we have these problems. We need to start looking at how we're going to bridge this gap in a way that makes sense, because we all have needs that are really important, that are pretty much the same. We need to be respected and loved. We need to be important. We need to be valued, particularly from our spouse. But if we don't learn how to get along with one another, how's that ever going to happen? It's sort of like we're looking at the surface of things. We've got to go deeper. We've got to look at some of the things that we want that we're not getting and find ways to learn about it. Is it all going to be through counseling? I mean, how many people don't go to counseling at some time in their life? We see the whole country that's getting psychotherapy. And it's not just for a short time. A lot of the time, we're looking at people getting not just months of therapy, but maybe years or even decades of therapy. And we learn all the things that we can about ourselves and what's wrong, but how do we actually make changes? Is it enough to just understand what our situation is? I say not. I mean, it's a start, but it's not the whole answer. We have to find ways of looking at want to be inspired, to want to change, and to be able to do that. And understanding it, as I said, is a first step. But how do we go back and undo or get rid of some of the challenges we faced as kids that have led us to have all the problems that we have in life, not just with relationships, but with our health? You know, physical disease is the body's expression of psycho-spiritual disease. Powerful statement there. And I'm going to say it a second time because I think it's that important. Physical disease is the somatic expression of psycho-spiritual dysfunction. And so in my office as a physician, I'm seeing people come in all the time with problems. They have headaches and backaches. They have indigestion. They're getting ulcers. They're coming down with all kinds of diseases. We're obese. We're getting type 2 diabetes. There are heart attacks and strokes. There are all these things that are happening to us. And what do we do in medicine? We do the same thing that we do outside of medicine, this culture. We treat the symptoms. We try to stop the diabetes from leading to a heart attack or a stroke or to some metabolic problem. We do what we can to make the hypertension go away with pills. We solve the problem of the heart attack after it's happened. We got to be proactive. We have to find ways of stopping these things before they get totally out of hand. And when we just use a system that blocks the symptoms, either with a law that says, no, you can't do that or you'll go to jail, or we give you a pill to stop it, what have we done to look at the underlying problem that we're facing? Well, generally not much. And that's why we need a huge evolution in our healthcare system. We can't just be using expensive drugs and technologies that really don't solve our problems that much. I mean, look at America. We're spending $8,000 per person per year. We spend more than twice of any other country in the world. And we have a healthcare system that's ranked what? 37th in the world in overall quality of care. And a lot of that is not because we don't have a great healthcare system that can deal with at least treating the symptoms. We're the best at that. But the disparities that we have and the way we approach solving the problem is like just trying to protect from the symptoms rather than look at the underlying causes. And that's why I've been working on a system that's quite different for a number of years now, since 1994. When I founded the Health Medicine Forum, and if you want to learn more about this, go to my website at drsaputo.com, that's S-A-P-U-T-O.com, and put in the search box Healing Circles. And what you'll learn about the Health Medicine Forum, which is a nonprofit educational foundation that's been around since 1994, is how we develop the system where we could work together with all disciplines being respected. So we're working integratively. We're looking at the whole person, body, mind, emotion, and spirit, rather than just trying to control symptoms. We're trying to listen to people and care about them so that they get the idea that we're really interested in them and that we'll try to do what we can to offer them the kind of therapy that's something that they can do and they're motivated to do, and to be preventive. So this new system is doing a lot to change the way we practice medicine at the Health Medicine Center in Walnut Creek, California. We do something called a healing circle, which really offers the kinds of things I've been talking about that lead to all this dysfunctional behavior that we're seeing. We're looking at ways of bringing different disciplines together. So we might have an MD who's an internist. We might have a psychologist. There may be somebody who does Chinese medicine with drugs or with herbs and acupuncture. Maybe Ayurveda. There are hundreds and hundreds of different disciplines that people who come to us can choose, who are willing to meet with them for 2 hours after they've written an autobiography of their physical, emotional, and spiritual health from birth to now. And when they do that, each person who's in this healing circle will read that autobiography in all those different domains and will do something to try to be with people, to listen and to care in a very deep way where people feel like somebody really is interested in them rather than just having 5 or 10 minutes in an office visit to get them back on their feet and back to work, as our healthcare system is getting more and more oriented to do. And the reason it's really convincing in part is because these circles are free. They're 2 hours long. We charge nothing for them. And we have a deep interest that has to do with listening to them without interrupting them and to care about them. And that combination is such a powerful tool that helps people to begin to trust and share and connect with. And I've seen in the couple of hundred circles that I've participated in, major changes in how people will look at what their issues are. They go deeper into the meaning of the illness in the context of their whole life story and how that plays out in their relationships and why it leads them to be as frustrated as they are with so many things in life that they're frustrated with. And it's a beautiful thing to go into that deep place and deal with some of the symptoms that people have at the level of cause. Then it's not like these people can't go back to the situations that were dysfunctional. They can. We never forget about anything, any part of our personality, ever. We can go back and be as dysfunctional as we want. But hopefully what we're learning is how to be people who can function better and to learn new options and not want to go back to that dark space that leads them to a relationship that's so dysfunctional that we're stepping on buttons of the other person or the other people in our community because we get so frustrated with how they make us feel in certain situations. Now, that's real healthcare, as opposed to disease care, where you use drugs and surgeries and technologies to try and make people feel better. So when we're looking at this business of partner abuse, where we're looking at the article that was published in the Women's Health Issues Journal, they found that a third of women experience some kind of intimate partner violence. About 20% get counsel, and about 11% actually discuss this with their physician. And of course, men are usually the perpetrators who are stronger and can be more offensive at trying to do something to express their violence. And so they basically are going to prisons or being punished in some way. We need to do something that's a little bit deeper than that. And maybe this system of health medicine that I've told you about, which is integrative, holistic, person-centered, and preventive, is a model that we can do something about that's deeper. And we look at the deepest needs we have as human beings. That, too, is absolutely vital if we're going to try to make changes that inspire people to want to be different. And it's not easy. I have a lot of compassion for people who grow up in these dangerous places in America where they don't really have the education, the support, love that they should have as children. I look at every child that's born as a child that should have opportunity and have a way of being able to be getting these qualities that I'm talking about. And so here we are talking about how do we stop this epidemic of violence that we have in America? How do we stop the epidemic of all the other diseases we have? How do we change from the system that's every person for themselves? That's a tough one. And it comes from being able to evolve to a higher level of consciousness where we're looking beyond our personal needs and where we want to give rather than take. It's about providing service. How do we do that? Well, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo. I wish Nurse Vicki was here today, but she's not. I'm missing her. I hope she catches a moose and it doesn't hurt it. She's not going to go shoot the moose. She's just going to be working with her wildlife biologist son, Kevin, to tag the moose and to learn things about it so the moose will do better. You know, in the same vein, we're talking about violence. We have another topic here that I promised to talk about that has to do with celebrity endorsement of different kinds of products, particularly foods or really almost anything. If somebody is a famous person, what happens? We tend to really admire them. We get great respect for them. We tend to believe what they say. And the fact is most of these, almost all of these endorsements are from people who we know well that we admire because they're movie stars or they're important political figures. And if they say something, it's like it has extra power. And we tend to go along with that power in a way that's silly. I mean, why should somebody like John Wayne tell me that smoking a camel is a good thing? Remember John Wayne, the cowboy back in the 50s and 60s? Well, John Wayne was a big smoker, and everybody loved him because he was a big movie star. And so he was a big smoker. And, by the way, he died of lung cancer. Should we have listened to John Wayne? MDs did the same thing back in the 40s, talking about the benefits of smoking. Look at some of the ads that are in the Journal of the American Medical Association about 15 years ago. There were ads in there for McDonald's food. You talk about fast food that doesn't have high nutrition. There you are. Or what about Sally Fields, who is talking about the benefits of Boniva, which is a bisphosphonate drug like Fosamax is, that's used to build bones that won't fracture as often. I mean, talk about something that just fries me is to listen to Sally tell us about that when she doesn't know the first darn thing about it. And she's an actress, and then she's promoting something that I think is way overused in this country in ways that lead to far more damage than benefit. We don't look for the underlying causes of osteoporosis. It's not a deficiency in Boniva or Fosamax. It's a problem with a lack of vitamin D, a lack of exercise, a lack of maybe enough calcium in our food some of the time, not enough vitamin D, not enough vitamin K. We need to have the micronutrients, the copper and boron and zinc and silica, all the things that we need to be able to have strong bones. I mean, are we going to believe Sally Field? And how about Beyonce, who's endorsing Coke? She got $50 million to endorse Coca-Cola. Do we think Coca-Cola is a healthy thing for people when we have this epidemic of obesity and we're seeing all this high fructose corn syrup that's being poured into our mouths? Or how about Madonna supporting Pepsi I mean, do we want to go out and buy lots of that stuff because these women who are superstars are telling us, oh, I like it, so you should like it too? And how about Kim Kardashian, who's backing a product called Quick Trim, which is a diet pill, which now is leading her to lots of problems because apparently there's a class action suit out there, as there should be. Why do we let people who are in these power positions do that sort of thing to us? It's because they are people that we use as role models. Silly. But you look at the whole advertising business. What's it about? It's about convincing you to buy somebody's product because they want the money that comes from it. And, of course, if they get the money, they're happy because what's the job of the CEO of the company? It's to provide return on investment for the products, okay, that company is buying or is selling or is making. And so here we are listening to Donald Trump talk to us about Trump steaks. Donald really an expert in meat, or David Beckham talking about Burger King? Sometimes we have to find a way to deal with what's happening by thinking. Look at the direct-to-consumer ads we see for drugs. I mean, they're telling you, you need this drug. We've got a drug for everything. You know, it's going to block symptoms. Do you think an antidepressant or a sleeping pill or an anti-anxiety drug is going to solve the reason why we have those problems? Not a chance. What they do is block the symptoms. And, of course, they're promoting it, and they want you to buy it so that they can have a return on investment. And look at how dishonest a lot of it is. And look at the part that's even fairly honest. I mean, look at a drug that's out there for so many different things, like the antidepressants, telling you, and yeah, it will help you with your depression, but it may cause seizures or it may cause weight gain. It may cause a problem with a heart attack or a stroke. It may cause death. You may have an allergic reaction from it. And it goes on and on and on. And you think somebody would be listening to that in a way where they're saying, do I want this drug really? You would think at least our doctors would do that. Why wouldn't our doctors learn more about the side effects of drugs than the actual benefits that they have just by themselves? It's because that's how we're trained. We learn in our training to use drugs and surgeries and technologies to stop the symptoms of people who have serious illnesses. And they can work for a while. I mean, look at the purple pill. I mean, you're out there buying all these different purple pills that are helpful for indigestion or acid reflux. And what are the problems with it? Does anybody tell you about that? They tell you that it blocks the acid in your stomach and that you can no longer digest your food right. It changes the microflora of the gut in a major way because it changes the pH. Look at that. What about the fact that you can't absorb B12 or iron or magnesium or calcium in that setting, and that it leads, after a couple of years of usage, to about a 45% increase in the risk for osteoporosis? Or the fact that because you can't absorb B12, that the risk for senile dementia goes up about 18%. And what about the fact that if you take it for more than 8 weeks, about 40% of people will have a rebound indigestion when they go off the pill because of an increase in production of acid? They tell you about that? No. Generally, what the gastroenterologists and internists and family practitioners are doing is saying, well, you got this problem? Well, let's just take this Prilosec or this Nexium or this Acifex or some of these drugs that are like that. We don't really take a hard look at what the side effects are and the long-term results. And then what's the real question is, why do you have it? What are we going to do about that? Are we going to listen to Sally Fields tell us to use Boniva if we've got osteoporosis? Or are we going to try and look at the underlying cause of what's going on and take some kind of action that makes more sense, that's looking at why we have it and what we can do to stop it from becoming more of a problem? These are the kinds of things that we don't pay enough attention to. We can think it through if we want to, but we're more naive. We want to do something that will make our symptoms go away, and we want somebody to help us do that so we don't have to change our lifestyle ourselves. Well, it's time for a network station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo. I'll be right back with more Prescriptions for Health radio, and we'll be talking about, do school-based kitchen gardens work? Stay with me. Welcome back to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo. As I mentioned earlier, Vicky's trekking in Alaska, chasing moose to try and see how they're doing. She doesn't have a gun. She's just trying to work with her son, Kevin, who's a wildlife biologist there. And they're going to shoot them with a dart, put them to sleep, draw some blood, measure a few things, and see if they can learn more about what moose need to have a healthier life. Anyway, insomnia is one of the things that's been a big issue, that is a big issue in this country. And we tend to look for ways to solve insomnia from outside of what we do to solve the problem. We need to look at the cause of what's going on, and what we tend to rely on are sleeping pills and anti-anxiety drugs and antidepressants. And what we need is, as I said, is to find out what the cause is and maybe do some things that make sense that are natural that can help us sleep better. And there was a wonderful study that came out that was actually a poll. It was the National Sleep Foundation in 2013 in February, studied sleep in America using a poll. And what they found is it was a very strong association between exercise and sleep. And that may not surprise as much because we know when we exercise, it tires us out. It also works out our frustrations. It works as an antidepressant and an anti-anxiety agent. And it's healthy for us. It makes us healthier in general in so many ways. And in this particular study, what they found is that exercisers and non-exercisers actually slept the same length of time. It was 6 hours and 51 minutes. Still doesn't get to that 8 hours we need, and we know that America's in the fast track, and we just don't have that much time. But when we sleep, people who exercise report better sleep than non-exercisers, even though they sleep the same length of time. They also found that vigorous exercisers were twice as likely to report a good night's sleep and less likely to report insomnia at all. They looked at two-thirds of the people who were doing vigorous exercise, and they didn't have much in the way of sleep issues. 72% of them didn't awaken early, and they were unable to return back to sleep. 69% were able to sleep easily, as opposed to 50% of people who were non-exercisers and 24% who were unable to get to sleep easily. So what do these sleep patterns mean? We're looking at people who can't get to sleep, people who get to sleep fairly early but wake up and can't go back to sleep very quickly, and people that wake up early and can't get back to sleep. They all, in general, reflect specific issues, specific kinds of problems that we see. For example, if you can't get to sleep, it's usually because your mind is overactive. And with an overactive mind, we're re-going over the events of the day, hoping that maybe it'll change if we keep thinking about it or it'll go away, but it doesn't. And so it may take more than 5 minutes to get to sleep and often can take anywhere from a half an hour to 2 or 3 hours. So that's about stress and anxiety. If you get to sleep fairly quickly, but you wake up a few hours later and then wake up repeatedly and have trouble getting back to sleep, that too is usually associated with anxiety, but it may have a little bit more of an element of depression associated with it too. Now, those people who get to sleep and sleep through but awaken at 4 or 5 in the morning and can't go back to sleep at all, this is a pretty reliable sign of depression. And so we should note those things. But there are many other causes of insomnia that range from pain to certain kinds of illnesses that we have, and things like sleep apnea. And I would refer you to go to drsaputo.com. It's S-A-P-U-T-O.com. And join the site, first of all, because it's free, and it has 2,300 audios and videos that I have made myself or with Vicky and have interviewed hundreds of people who are top experts in their field. And in this site are 33 health assessments, one of which includes insomnia. It takes about 3 or 4 minutes to take the assessment. There are yes or no or multiple choice answers. And what will come back to you is information about what you need to know about your situation with insomnia that's specific to the way you filled out the assessment. And again, all this information is free. It's like sitting with me in the office as you're asking questions about what's going on and my giving you feedback about what to do. So exercise, as it turns out, is a pretty powerful antidepressant as well. It was a fellow from a PhD from Duke University. His name is James Blumenthal, who did a study on Prozac that was published in Archives of Internal Medicine in 1999. And what he did is he compared the effects of Zoloft, an SSRI antidepressant, to exercise in 156 patients who were over the age of 50, and had these people either take the Zoloft or do exercise for 30 minutes several times a week at about 75% of their maximum heart rate. So it wasn't real hard exercise. And what he found is that there was an equal effect between exercise and Zoloft in the ability to get people to sleep. And what was interesting is that after 6 months, 38% of these people who took Zoloft were still depressed, as opposed to 8% who were in the exercise group. So here we've got some objective data from a wonderful university that is giving us information we need to know about the value of exercise in preventing depression and, of course, the insomnia that often goes with it. Then again in 2007, he published another article in a journal called Psychosomatic Medicine. And there he compared the effect of exercise and in one group, of Zoloft in another, and placebo in a third, in 202 depressed patients for 16 weeks. And what he found is that the depression was helped in 47% of the people who took Zoloft, 45% of those who just exercised, and 31% of those people that took placebo. So when you look at this, you can see that exercise and placebo are about the same. Exercise and Zoloft are about the same. Placebo was a little bit less, but it was interesting that Zoloft was only 17% better than placebo, and of course it has many side effects. And that brings me to the question of what should we be doing when we're treating people who are depressed and can't sleep? And of course, the answer is not to take drugs if you can get the same effect doing natural things like exercising. And so that's something you should consider. It's interesting that non-exercisers have about twice the incidence of sleepiness as people who exercise. So people who were non-exercisers had sleepiness about 24% of the time versus 13% of the people who did exercise. And this sleepiness was enough that it caused changes in quality of life that were distracting from it, such as not being able to stay awake while driving or when they're doing social activities. They also found that, which is, I think, fascinating, is that the incidence of sleep apnea was nearly twice that of what they saw in people who were exercisers. Another interesting study that was done looked at the amount of time we sit affects the quality of our sleep. If we sit more than 8 hours a day, we'll have more of a problem sleeping than if we don't. They also found, and I find this fascinating, that the decrease of type 2 diabetes was one half that of people who slept or who exercised or were up at least 8 hours a day as opposed to sitting. So all these things point out what we can do to try and change our problems with insomnia, because you really don't want to be taking a drug. The drugs all have side effects. They never solve the underlying issue that causes the insomnia. It's important to do what's natural, and I think exercise and placebo, you know, would be great things to do, particularly in combination. So I would certainly recommend that. But in general, we should be looking at the underlying causes of why people can't sleep. And if, again, you go to drsabuto.com, take the insomnia survey or the insomnia health assessment, it will be something that will teach you about your particular problem. And there are probably 15 or 20 different causes of insomnia that are referred to in this particular assessment. Now, there is sleep advice that has been given by the people who are involved with sleep. And what they have found is that if we go on ahead and follow these tips that they suggest, we'll probably have an easier time sleeping. Of course, vigorous exercise is important. And what's interesting is that you can exercise any time of the day. It can be morning or night or before bed. It doesn't make any difference. The old sleep advice that was issued was really saying that you shouldn't exercise before you go to bed, but they've changed that now and said that exercise at any time is valuable. And, of course, sleeping in a quiet, dark, cool, comfortable room is important. Going ahead and doing some kind of relaxing ritual like taking a warm bath or listening to music or putting some lavender in the bath water is helpful to calm us down, particularly if we're anxious. Another thing that was interesting is they said don't oversleep, because if you oversleep, it's just as strong a marker of stress or depression. Now, a lot of people, you know, who are depressed sleep a lot. And, of course, that interferes with our alertness throughout the day. Bright light is another thing to pay attention to, especially at night. You want to avoid any bright lights because that interferes with the production of melatonin. It turns it off. And, of course, we need melatonin to put us into a deep sleep. And in the morning, it's important that we are stimulated by bright light. So we should open up those curtains and look outside and look for that bright sun and blue sky, and it'll make us alert much better. We should save our worries for another time than nighttime, but that's easier said than done. We do the best that we can. And then, of course, if we have prolonged problems with not being able to sleep, we need to see our doctor and talk about what can we do that's a little bit that investigates what the cause of the insomnia is. So this whole business of insomnia is really important to pay attention to because it affects the quality of our life in major ways. It's a telltale sign that things may or may not be going well with our health. And we, if we're having trouble sleeping, should see somebody who can work through the challenges that we face in our life after we have looked for the physical causes for why we may not be able to sleep. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo. Now, on another note, how important is it for our children to be able to learn about how they run their lives as opposed to just learning about facts in school? You know, we get over-focused on STAR tests, and we tend to think that STAR testing is the cat's meow. And it's important that we get the maximum we can out of our education. But it's also important that we learn something about our life and why education is important, and look for the reasons, if we're not doing well in school, as to why that's the case. We should be looking at lifestyle in lots of ways, particularly with our relationships with other people. We should be wanting to practice the golden rule. We should be wanting to give rather than take. We should be wanting to develop community and support one another as we go through school. And as I spoke earlier about this topic, I think that this should become a regular course that is given in all schools at every level so that we're not just intellectually bright, but we're also emotionally and spiritually developed as we could be. One of the aspects of good health has to do with how we eat. And there's an interesting program that was published in the Journal of Nutrition Education and Behavior that talked about school-based kitchen gardens and how they're coming across. And really, the mantra of this group is grow it, try it, you might just like it. And schools are embracing to encourage kids to eat more fruits and vegetables. So these community-based kitchen garden programs are scheduled so that what happens is the school curriculum includes about 45 minutes a week in a garden class, so they're actually there growing the fruits and vegetables with somebody who's a garden specialist. And then for another hour and a half a week, they're in the kitchen with a cooking specialist, with a good chef, who can give these kids knowledge and skills so that they can develop environmentally sustainable gardening, along with the skills to prepare and cook three or four course meals that's all basically made of fresh produce from the garden. The dishes are prepared and include things like homemade pastries and bread and pasta, salads, curries, and desserts. This study was done in Australia at the University of Melbourne and at the Deakin University there, and they recruited a total of 764 kids in grades 3 to 6 and 562 parents to participate in the program. And one of the major themes that emerged from the study is that kids were eating and appreciating the new foods because they were it was something that it was their thing. They were doing it. They were more interested in trying the foods, and they introduced the kids to a lot of new ingredients and tastes, and within a short time, they found that most of the kids were prepared to try at least a new dish, at least to taste it. They also found, teachers discovered, that there'd been a noticeable improvement in the nutritional quality of the food that kids were bringing to school for snacks and lunches, which speaks volumes to how effective this is. So it's really good to see. They also found that when the kids were sitting down together and sharing, enjoying a meal, they were building more social skills and were more willing to test some of the foods that they thought must be awful because they were vegetables, right? But they had no pressure to eat. So I think this is really a program that I hope will come to more schools. You know, we have some in our area, in the San Francisco Bay Area. There are several schools that have this kind of a program, particularly about growing the food. They have less of a program in terms of sharing the cooking part of it. But I think that there are this is probably something that's going to happen soon because these research studies have been done have shown a lot. The other thing that's important to point out is that the schools themselves in general don't feed kids good quality food. They're way too starchy. They have too many trans fats. What we need to be doing is giving kids healthy nutrition that has foods that are rich in fruits and vegetables so they get all the antioxidants and essential fatty acids and vitamins and minerals that they need so that they can function right. And there have been a number of studies on school lunches, not just in schools but also in prisons. And I know the studies that were done by a fellow named Schoenthaler about 20 or 25 years ago showed that if you fed the kids in New York, which they did, one healthy lunch, and the prisoners in New York one healthy lunch, that violence went down 44%. So we're looking at something that's not complicated to do, that's good for kids and good for the whole system because if there's less violence, and by the way, they did better on their STAR testing at that time too. They were smarter kids. So if you don't put in the materials that we need and don't have the products that should be made by ourselves, and you can't make them if you don't have the raw materials, you're simply not going to do well. And we know particularly for pregnant mothers or mothers that are people that are women that are trying to get pregnant, that the diet that you eat makes a big difference in how well your child is going to do from the point of birth defects, but also from the point of how smart they are. So I like this idea of school-based kitchen gardens that are really bringing a message to the kids that they like, that works, and is going to make them healthier. All right, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo. The last topic I want to touch on has to do with conflicts of interest in medical schools that are imposed by the pharmaceutical industry. And there was an article that was published, okay, in the February issue of a journal called Medical Care that looked at psychiatrists who are exposed to conflicts of interest during their residency. And wondering if they would be less likely to prescribe brand-name antidepressants after graduation if there were rules that would block these people from being able to get to the students and bribe them with the kinds of things that they do. So I thought this was a really good study that should be something that we take a hard look at because I have to tell you, the pharmaceutical power is unbelievable. They're a multi-billion dollar industry. Maybe the most make the most profit of any industry in the country. And their interest is in selling product. They don't really care so much about whether or not the product helps, although they prefer that it does because then you'll buy more of it, and that's a good thing to do. But we need to put some restrictions on what they do because I know that when I was in medical school, these guys were all over the place, guys and women, particularly good-looking women, who were more apt to get into your office because they were attractive. And they had an effect on how we prescribe things. And they would come by a lot, and they would offer us things, you know, gifts like free meals and medicine samples. Often in the time that I was developing my practice, they would offer free trips. They would take you golfing or take you hunting or do something that you would like and provide you with all the medicines that you want were free samples. But, of course, most of the time they were their latest samples that cost a lot of money. There were new products that they wanted to promote. So you would prescribe them. And then they give you little things to remember, like a pen with the name of the drug on it, or paper or prescription pads that were like that. So there's a huge influence on that. And the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania did a study to look at that focused only on antidepressants. And the reason they picked them is because antidepressant use has increased by nearly 400% from 1988 to 2008. That's 400% over 20 years. And they wanted, and they wondered that if there were regulations that prevented pharmaceutical representatives to get at the interns and residents, if that would make a difference in what they prescribed after they got into clinical practice. And what they did is they looked at the policies that were present early when there weren't conflicts of when the conflicts of interest were allowed, and then they looked at the psychiatrists who had conflicts of interest restrictions, and they found a big difference. They looked at 652 psychiatrists from 162 residency programs, and they found that the physicians fell into two categories. Half graduated before 2001, before the conflict of interest training guidelines were implemented, and the other half graduated in 2008, after medical centers adopted these conflicts of interest policies. And what they found is that the psychiatrists who had their programs that graduated in 2008 or after were not prescribing so many antidepressants that were brand names, which, of course, is very interesting because what's happening with this whole policy is that the pharmaceutical industry is interested in selling their latest high-priced, fashionable drugs that they're doing direct-to-consumer ads on. And if they can get the doctors to prescribe that, that's worth a fortune because a lot of these antidepressants are selling for an awful lot of money. The pharmaceutical industry is making $10 billion a year from the sale of those products. So they found that this was a really good thing for them to do because it changed that. And, of course, the pharmaceutical industry is not interested in the rules. They're more interested in what they sell. And so when they get a hold of physicians, what they're doing is they're promoting a lot of time, which is illegal, by the way, the sale of off-label uses for drugs, which means that the FDA hasn't approved it for that use, but they're pushing it anyway because they take it on the side and they say, ah, you don't know this because it's not written as an indication by the FDA, but we're doing research now, and that research is promising and suggesting that you should be using this for those problems as well. So that's what's happening still, but I think that we're waking up to the fact that this is something that we can't continue to support. So the policies that are coming into effect from the medical schools and the residency programs is something I want to support. Well, we're at the end of the show, and I want to remind you that we'll be back to talk about what's new in the news and health every Monday morning on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be available 24/7 on PRN.FM. If you enjoyed today's show and would like to have more information on the topics I discussed, go to Dr. Saputo Radio on DrSaputo.com and check out our Fast Track videos. And remember, lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe, so if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life. Have a great week. We'll see you next time.